Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they applied their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I hope you're well. I hope you are happy. I hope you are managing as well as you can right now. I hope perhaps that you are enjoying a bit more freedom, particularly if you're in the southern state as I am, where things have been a little tough of late. I hope you're enjoying the relaxation of some of our restrictions. If, of course, you're somewhere else in the world where things are tough, we feel for you. And one day at a time, don't forget to breathe. As we go to air today, it is actually 1 month until Christmas and only 5 weeks until the end of 2020. And I don't know about you, but I know that for me, and maybe for many of us, we've kind of patiently waited out this year, believing somewhere in our semi-consciousness that when 2020's over, our annus horribilis, then life's going to return to some kind of normal. We get to wipe the slate clean and start again with a brand new year. But of course, that's not the way this works, is it? Global pandemics don't just shut up shop saying, well, that was my year over, I'm done. This thing's going to stick around and change things for us in big ways and small ways for a while yet to come, maybe permanently, in both good ways and bad ways. We just don't know. And there's a part of me that's still grappling with that a little, that life can be fundamentally changed by something so outside of our control. But of course, that does happen to people all the time, doesn't it? There are always events that change the course of what we thought was going to be, the life or experience that we thought we were going to have. And then recently I saw a quote. It's purportedly a Zen proverb, although I can't confirm that because I did see it on the internet. But the quote was, obstacles do not block the path, they are the path. So let's just contemplate that for a moment. Obstacles do not block the path, they are the path. And that little saying really has reframed things for me. It was never written that every year, every experience, that life itself should or would or could play out the way we expect it or the way that it has previously. That's what we call a thinking error or a cognitive bias, that human tendency to make assumptions, to make rules about how things should be based on nothing other than how things have been in the past or how perhaps we want them to be. This global pandemic and the year that's been, it's not an obstacle that blocked us from doing what we should have been doing, living how we should have been living. It is life. It is the path. Every year and every day and every moment unfolds as it does in real time. There is no predestined path. And as humans, we like prediction and routine because it makes it easier for us to manage life. But somehow, that prediction can also be what causes us to come unstuck. If we get caught up in what should have been and then feel hard done by or ripped off because it didn't happen as we imagined or planned or expected, then we can end up in a pretty miserable, angry and bitter place, or at the very least, we're disappointed. But when we remember that we were the ones who imagined that hopeful year, we were the ones who predicted that was the way it was going to happen. It was literally all in our heads as a species. We made plans, but life didn't pan out that way, and it won't sometimes, maybe often. And when we can wrap our heads around that, it really helps to accept it. It's not necessarily easy, not necessarily comfortable, and we don't want to deny the difficulty or the disappointment or distress in any of that. It can be very uncomfortable. But if we can do it, if we can see life as a moment-by-moment experience that we have no control over, that we can't predict, that we can't plan for, that wasn't predestined, if we can accept that and what we see as obstacles become not obstacles at all, it's just life unfurling in that moment-by-moment and sometimes unpredictable ways because there isn't a path. And we can learn to get comfortable with that. If we can learn to get comfortable with that, we're just in a much more resilient place. We're better able to adapt in that moment by moment. Which, of course, is not to say that there's no point in planning. Planning's still very important, but it's a case of plan for the best, maybe expect the worst, and then just play what's in front of you. And that's what we're talking about in today's episode, understanding ourselves as individuals and as a species and finding the courage to live our best lives, be our best selves as life unfurls moment by moment. But before we get into that, I just want to let you know that if you lead a team at work or in any setting, if you're responsible for helping others to thrive and grow and be their best selves, we've just popped a guide to creating thriving, motivated teams. It's a how-to guide on the Potential Psychology website at potential.com.au. It's absolutely free and it'll take you through how to help individuals to thrive and how doing that transforms effectiveness and collaboration and commitment in your team. And how thriving individuals working together creates a thriving workplace culture. And then three simple tools that you can use with individuals, those in your team, to thrive and flourish. All free, all pretty simple, straightforward, all things that I use all the time. And it's perfect if you're a leader looking to improve engagement and motivation and to really help your people to be their best. So that's on the website at potential.com.au. But I think it's time that we talk to today's guest. I've talked enough. Let's go, shall we? So with me today, speaking from Sydney, is Eric Winters, a self-leadership coach, and I'm going to ask him a bit about that in a moment, a consultant, a speaker, and author of Swipe Right on Your Best Self, Simple Steps to a Bolder Life with Fewer Regrets. Eric spent many years working in the corporate sector around the globe, helping leaders and their teams to become their best selves. And we're here to talk about exactly that, becoming your best self. Welcome, Eric.
Ellen, good afternoon. What a pleasure to be with you.
It is delightful to have you here. I have been reading Swipe Right on Your Best Self and very much enjoying it. I'm keen to know, self-leadership. You refer to yourself as a self-leadership coach. What does that mean?
So when I'm referring to self-leadership, I'm referring to that set of skills that we can use to manage ourselves, to manage our minds and manage our actions, because self-leadership, from my perspective, is the foundation. We've got to get that sorted out first before we seek to influence others positively. So I worked with IBM, perhaps, oh, it's a long, long time ago now, Ellen. Dare I say, about 30 years ago, I worked in Scotland. My first job with IBM. Fantastic. But I noticed that there were times when the pressure was on, and it was often on. So imagine that the Royal Bank of Scotland's ATM network has just crashed. It's down. Well, you can imagine there's quite a lot of excitement in IBM when the entire ATM network is down. And under those circumstances, some managers really were able to step up, maintain their equanimity, get the best out of themselves, and get the best out of their teams. They just had this extraordinary capacity to manage themselves, to lead themselves, and then lead others. And I noticed there were other managers who to some degree would panic and get anxious, and their stress would contaminate the rest of the team. It's astonishing how contagious stress can be. So I witnessed this in Scotland, where I worked for about 8 years. Then I moved to the Middle East, and the same thing happened there. I was in Abu Dhabi for 2 years, again working in IT. Different culture entirely, but the same phenomenon would express itself. The pressure was on, some would step up, do great work, and others would lose it. I saw the same thing in Germany during my time in Munich. Fabulous place, Ellen, if you get any, if we ever get permission to leave.
And get I know, up. One day.
And I saw the same thing in Australia. So I was curious, what made the difference? And it turns out there's a well-known set of skills, behavioral skills, around how we can help ourselves and help others to choose to do high-performance quality work, even when it's challenging. I'm not so interested in people doing good work when it's not challenging. It's not that hard when it's easy. But increasingly in life, especially this year, hey, actually, it's been very challenging.
Absolutely. And so those core skills, and I'm thinking, you know, for me, I'm thinking it's things like being able to, as you say, manage your emotions, manage your thoughts as they're attached to their emotions. I suppose understanding yourself is a big part of that. You know, why do I react in the way that I do? And a capacity, therefore, for a bit of self-reflection, you know, when something has occurred, did I handle that the best way I could have? What was the impact on others? So some emotional intelligence capabilities. What else is in there? Are there other things that I've missed?
Yes, well, it's quite a suite of things. But you've hit on the key things. We do need to understand ourselves. But it all begins with self-awareness, noticing. It all starts with noticing. We need to notice what we're telling ourselves, to notice the familiar stories, notice our experience, notice what we're feeling. And once we've noticed what we're doing, we're then in a position to make a choice. Okay, if I carry on doing what I'm doing, is that going to take me in a good direction? Or if I continue to behave like this, am I going to be, in a sense, behaving like a poorer version of myself? So it starts with self-awareness, because as I know you know very well, Ellen, humans have a habit. In fact, for perhaps much of our lives, we're not really choosing what we're going to be doing at all. We're on a kind of autopilot. We are creatures of habit, and we spend perhaps half of our lives in our heads, just imagining the future, reliving the past, and on this kind of habitual treadmill, just being nudged in certain directions by urges and feelings rather than choosing what we're going to do.
So that awareness, that noticing, paying attention to what's going on, and then having the capacity to make, I guess, the best choices in each scenario that you're facing.
Absolutely. Which means that in order to make a choice, so what would I like to be doing, we need to know in advance what matters to us. When we're under stress, this is no time to be considering the bigger picture in life. So when we're under extraordinary challenge and pressure, it's no time to begin to start reflecting, what does matter to me in life? No. We need to explore what's going to make our lives meaningful and purposeful and authentic. What is going to make my life personally authentic in advance of our challenges? So in a sense, we've got this first piece is deciding what matters. And then the second piece is getting better at noticing whatever we're doing, just noticing. Yeah, am I on track or am I a little bit off track? What is my inner experience? Getting better, more aware of our inner worlds. And then the third skill is developing the capacity to disengage from unhelpful thoughts and feelings, and to engage with helpful thoughts and feelings. So those two things, sort of detaching from what is unhelpful and attaching to ideas that help move us in the direction we want to, is the third skill. So three skills, when combined, will help us to more often, not all the time, but for more of the time, choose to take action that's better aligned with the kind of people we'd like to be.
And so that is very much the idea behind your book, Swipe Right on Your Best Self, this idea of being our best selves, having the skills, having the capabilities, having the self-knowledge, knowing how perhaps we get pushed and pulled by other people's expectations, and then being able to make conscious choice around, you know, well, what is my best self? Who is it that I want to be, and what kind of life do I want to live? What led you to write the book? I mean, I'm guessing there was obviously that those years of experience of observation of how people tend to respond. Were there other drivers?
There's an awful lot of science and good ideas and strategies around how we can manage our minds effectively. When I first moved into the space of psychology, I began in the area of counseling, So initially, my first master's was in counseling and psychotherapy. And whilst I was in that domain, I learned about a particular approach, which is the one we've been talking about, called ACT, Acceptance mm-hmm. and Commitment Training. And it was all being used overwhelmingly to help people who were struggling in some really painful conditions. So it could be anxiety, post-traumatic stress, obsessive compulsive disorder, grief, depression. These really difficult experiences. And as I learned about this approach, I thought, well, this is extraordinary. There's a lot of evidence that it's really helpful. And then I discovered, hang on, this exact same set of skills can also be applied to people who aren't struggling with the intense pains in life, but are simply struggling with the regular pains of being alive, the normal human challenges that we all have.
Complexities of being human beings.
Yes, it's part and parcel. The challenges of just being in any relationship, it's going to be challenging. It's going to be challenging if you're not in a relationship and you'd like to be in one. It's going to be challenging if you start a relationship and staying in a relationship or leaving a relationship. And then there's work. So pretty much all of life is about meeting challenges well. Mm. The quality of our lives, I believe, depends to a significant extent on how well we can meet these challenges. And so I'd learned these strategies for helping people who are distressed to some degree and who need counseling. But it struck me that this exact same set of skills could really be used to help everyone, absolutely everyone. And I finished the book with a 7-step model to helping people to choose to do what's important but challenging. And the ideas in that model are well known to counselors and coaches and therapists and psychologists, but they're not well known to the public. I wanted to write a book that was highly accessible, easy to read, cut it out all the psychobabble and unnecessary padding. I'm exhausted from reading books that are 3 inches thick just because they're full of stories. I'd like to get to the point. It's a thin book, isn't it?
It is. It's a nice, neat little compact book.
It is. And I'm making that
very easy to put in my handbag and carry around with me and then, dip into as I've needed to and as I've read it.
Grand. It's an easy read. So I wanted to make these ideas easily accessible to the public. That was my idea, Aaron. But what's happened is coaches and psychologists and counselors are buying copies for themselves and they're coming back and saying, Eric, I need 5 more, please. I'm going to give them to my clients. Now, I never meant them to be popular with coaches and psychologists, but it turns out they are very keen to get them into the hands of the people they work with. So it's a wonderful bonus.
And I can understand that because I think it is like a little handbook or a little manual that captures a lot of, as you say, most of this stuff is in some way in the public domain already, but it's in the domain of academia, which is not easily accessible, and trying to find, even with the best will in the world, probably even for those of us who do spend a lot of time delving into academic research, trying to find something that you could then hand to a client or a colleague or anyone really who's interested in, delving a little deeper into why they do what they do and what shapes their behavior is not so easy. So you do cover off a lot of those. And I love that point about wanting to make that information more accessible to a broader audience, because that's very much why we talk about this stuff on the podcast, because I have exactly the same kind of belief that, psychologists and therapists and counselors and all of these people who have domain expertise in human behavior, we haven't been perhaps as good in the past at sharing that with a broader audience. We've waited until people come to see us perhaps in those really difficult circumstances. So I'm wondering whether for you there's almost a preventative type role here for people to have that level of understanding, to have this knowledge so that, as you say, you don't wait until the crisis hits to have the tools at hand.
Agreed. I wish I had had my book a long time ago, because without these ideas, we're very self-critical creatures. Why am I failing to lose weight, say, or to get fit, or to succeed to the extent I want to in my career? Why can't I sustain progress towards what I care about? Why am I unhappy? And it turns out there are lots of reasons why, living in the world we live in, with the biology we've got, it's no wonder we're unhappy. Mm. It's no wonder we have a sense at times of living meaningless lives, pointless lives, going through the routine each day, perhaps working hard, but not feeling satisfied, not feeling nourished by the experience of being alive. So there's lots of really good reasons why every single one of us, inevitably, without help, will end up achieving less than we could and possibly experiencing the number one regret of the dying.
Which was the question I was just about to ask you. So perfect segue.
Well, of course, as coaches, we read minds, don't we, Alan?
We do.
Yes, the number one regret of the dying. And as I know you're aware, a palliative care nurse, Bronnie Ware, wrote a book a few years ago, The Top Five Regrets of the Dying. So she was taking care of people in their last weeks or months. And people could be very honest, be really frank as they neared their end and told her, actually, you know what, I'd have changed if I could have done. And they shared it. So she compiled these ideas. The number one regret, the top regret of the dying is, I wish I'd had the courage to live a life true to myself and not the life that others expected of me. Courage to live lives true to ourselves. The ideas I've included in the book are ideas backed by behavioral science on how we can do exactly that. How can we develop courage? Courage is a skill. It's not something you've got a certain fixed amount of or not. It's a skill. It's something we do.
And we can practice.
We can get better. We can't do it overnight. Like all skills, we get better over time, but we can get better at identifying what we care about, recognizing what's cropping up in our inner worlds that holds us back sometimes, and developing the capacity to take action even while we feel uncomfortable, uncertain, we've got self-doubt perhaps, manageable levels of anxiety. Turns out we should not be waiting until we feel great before we take action. We should not procrastinate on living meaningful lives. Meaningful life, a purposeful life, it's going to include some challenge. It's going to be doing things while fear is still present.
Yes, it's one of those fascinating things, even about, you know, you so often hear, and we probably do it ourselves, I'll do that when I'm feeling motivated, you know, when I'm ready, when I'm less stressed, when I've got more time, when I'm this, when I'm that. We make lots of reasons for why we're not doing something. And I know certainly in relation to motivation, I often say it's, you know, motivation's not something that we find down the back of the couch. It's something that we create by the doing of it. So yes, that being able to step even with this fear, you know, just to take those small steps, and then the motivation and the courage, I'm guessing as well, kind of come as we do the doing of whatever it is that pushes us out of our comfort zone.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So Susan David said, courage is fear walking. This lovely idea. Yeah. So it's coming along with us. Yeah, come on, yes. Fear. Yeah, we're doing this thing. I'm going to do this thing. I've got no guarantees that this thing is going to work, but it's important. So I'm going to ask for help at work. I'm going to try a more challenging role, perhaps. I'm going to say no to inappropriate behavior, maybe, in the workplace. That many things at work require challenge, important things, include the experience of being challenged. And there will be some fear. So, yeah, the better we can get at asking for what we want, speaking up in meetings, being heard, being seen, trying, being willing to try, and being willing to not be good at something immediately, Ellen. I think a lot of us would like to be good at something, but we're not so keen on sucking at it for a while before we get there. But there's no other route. So if we can develop the willingness, we don't have to like it. This is the good news. We don't have to like it. But we do need to do it. If we're going to get good at something, we're going to have to be willing to experience, some degree of ongoing incompetence before we develop competence.
And the discomfort that comes with that.
Oh,
so, yeah. Eric, fear is one element here. The other thing that you raise in the book that I found really interesting was this notion of learning to, whether it's learning to live or learning to work around or ignore, I'm not sure what the framework is, others' expectations of us. So, you know, so many of us, we don't try things because we feel that other people wouldn't approve, or they don't think it's who we are, or they'd be surprised or upset that other people have these expectations of us. But you argue that we need to let that go.
Yeah, very true. You and I, and all of us, we're a bit like croutons in a soup. Do you remember? You don't see them very often now, Ellen, but there was a time.
The old French onion soup. And
little bits of bread, bits of toast put on top. And if you left them for long enough, they would soak up that soup. And you and I are a little bit like croutons, soaking up cultural expectations for what people like us, how we ought to behave, what the correct and a culturally approved way is of everything, of speaking, what kind of volume will be approved of, when is it right to talk, when should you be quiet, what kind of jobs are you allowed to aspire to as a woman or as a man, and how should we behave? So all of us have been so steeped in this messaging, we confuse it often as being our own ambition. So the ambitions of others can be soaked into us so deeply that we think, no, that's really how I want to behave, when actually it's how culture wants us to behave, or our families want us to behave, or our partners. Sometimes our partners have some very clear ideas about what kind of role we ought to be having. So yes, part of the skill is developing this capacity to identify, and not in an afternoon, but over time, and to continually revisit, actually, what is it that matters to me? How would I like to show up day in, day out, not just now and again, but on an ongoing basis? How would I like to show up so that when I get to the end, and it's dreadful news, but there is an end, but when we get to the end, we can say, actually, you know what? I gave that a really good shot. I played my hand pretty well.
So there's really two pieces to that. Part of that is that self-awareness, so knowing what's important to me as an individual, separate from all of those influences that you've just described. And the second thing is that courage then to be able to step away from those things, because they can be really, you know, like you said, we're the croutons. So it's very deeply ingrained. It is soaked into us. And to be able to step away from that and do something that perhaps people around us might feel is controversial or, you know, not the done thing, is that's hard, isn't it?
It is hard. And there are skills that we can develop to help ourselves. So the old-fashioned way of handling fear is just to use willpower, to just do it, you know, knuckle down, use grit, and that is one way. So, you know, all credit to willpower. It has its place. However, there's an alternative set of skills where we can change our relationship to the fear without getting rid of it. So it's possible for us to notice this sense of, oh, hang on, if I do this, others won't approve, and to notice the fear as it comes up. So the old strategy might have been just to fight your way through the fear, or to try to get rid of the fear somehow, just to beat it into submission, argue with yourself, oh, there's no reason I shouldn't be feeling that way. But a third strategy is instead to leave the fear, just leave it where it is, but change your relationship to it. Become an observer of it. Get some healthy psychological distance between you and that fear. And we can do that by noticing it and naming it. As I know you're well aware, noticing and naming. And something extraordinary happens when we're able to do that. It's not easy. Mid-trigger, this is not a small ask, but mid-trigger, when you're feeling that reactivity well up inside you, if you can notice So, oh, you know, that there it is. And give it a name. Name it. Oh, there's the anxiety. And then the moment we do that, we're stepping back just a little and the influence drops off. As Daniel Siegel said, we can name it to tame it. So we can tame these fears. I don't think we should be ever trying to get rid of them. I think if you've got a pulse and you're a human being, these fears are going to well up, whether they're warranted or not. So, but we can get better at noticing and naming and then choosing with wisdom. Actually, under these circumstances today, does it make sense for me to move towards my goals? Or, and sometimes, actually, maybe today, I ought to be taking consideration of the needs of others. And at times, that is what we'll want to do.
And it's only when we can get that kind of psychological distance from it, when we can kind of step back and view these things as a separate piece rather than kind of getting so absorbed in it and fighting it and dwelling in it and feeling it, you know, when we can step back, that then we're able to take those things into consideration. Otherwise, we're so deeply involved in it personally, we can't see what's going on for us, let alone what's going on for other people, can we?
Not at all. I think of it as sometimes being like being on a train of thought, Ellen, being on a train of thought. And we can get in our heads, no, I just know this is going to work out. I just know they won't like it. Oh, I just know. And off goes the train and it can take us away from doing what we would like to do. But if we're going to change that, we need to notice that we're on the train of thought. We've got to notice, oh, hang on, just a moment. What's written on the front of this train? It's never going to work. Okay. And instead of staying on the train, we can choose to step off it onto the platform of the present moment. Get off the train of thought onto the platform of the present moment and then consider with that little bit of distance, And then we can decide if perhaps we're going to get on a different train, one that's going to take us to a better place.
And need be, if need be, wave goodbye to that train that said it was never going to work.
Yes.
Watch it disappear over the horizon.
Well, yes, but it's probably on a loop.
Well, yes, it will come back.
It's like a circle line in London. I think it'll be back.
That's a very good metaphor. I like that metaphor. Eric, can you tell us a bit about, you write in the book about the three predicaments that stop us from living our best lives. Can you tell us what they are?
Yes. There are three, and you know what, there's probably more, but I thought I'd stop at three, Melanie.
Three is about all our brain can manage, isn't it?
It is. So three human predicaments which do hold us back and have us living less courageously than we might. The first one is that we live in two worlds. Most animals just live in the real world. They look around, see something scary, move away, see something tasty to eat, move towards it. So they live in a landscape. We do too. But we also live in a mindscape. So we've got an internal world and we can remember stuff and we can think about stuff in the future and we can think thoughts. We can talk to ourselves in our heads. So we've got an inner world and we're also influenced by what's inside our inner world. So we will move away from thoughts and feelings that are uncomfortable and towards feelings that feel good. So this would be all fine and dandy, except that we tend to fill our inner worlds with negativity. So we've got this negativity bias and we tend to dwell on what's not gone well in the past, the wrongs that have been committed against us, Ellen, the crimes, the disappointments, the setbacks, the betrayals. The mind goes there in a flash. And the other place it loves to go, is into fearful futures. How things might not work out well at all. And the problem is when we're in this world, we are hugely influenced by things that do not exist. Mm. Ideas. Now, the embarrassment, if I was to speak in front of that group and I stumbled, I made a mistake, I forgot my words, I'd just die. Oh. And a part of us truly believes that. It truly believes we just die. And when we're in our heads like that, we will be nudged very forcefully by our minds to back off. to avoid, to put off until tomorrow. So we avoid doing the courageous things that will make life meaningful. So that's the first problem. We've got this kind of virtual reality we live in, but it's not much fun. Well, parts of it are quite fun, but a lot of it, when we're lost in that world, when we're lost in it, it will take us away from meaningful life. The second human predicament that I put forward is that we live in a world of junk values. We're being fed junk values. So advertising is lying to us all the time, is telling us that happiness will be ours. We will be popular and happy and contented if we'll just buy the right scent. It's all it takes. If you could just get the right scent, or if you're going through, you remember airports, Ellen? It's been a while.
It's been a while, hasn't it? Yes, I have vague memories of airports.
but I recall dimly in duty free, the imagery in duty free of how you can be happy. Well, you just need the same watch that Leonardo DiCaprio wears, and you too can be cool and sophisticated and popular and all the rest of it. So we're being fibbed to. And it wouldn't matter if it was just once or twice, but it's relentless. So every time you turn on the TV, read a magazine, look on Facebook, go down the high street.
Yeah, social media.
Oh, wow. Yes, social messages from social media, how you can be happy. And you look at everyone's abs. I'm just appalled at how fit everyone is. Ellen, it does not make me... Well, I feel temporarily hopeful, but not for long. And then so there's this gap created. So the world of social media and the world of advertising creates a gap. It tells us you do not have enough. You do not, you're not popular enough. You're not wealthy enough. You're not good looking enough. You're not enough, but you would be if you just gave us a small number of dollars and we'll give you a smell or a piece of clothing, which will change everything.
Or a fitness program. That seems to be one that pops up a lot, isn't it? Follow this fitness program and yes, happiness will be yours.
Yes. And the predominance of those fitness program adverts goes up the later into the night. So if you tell your, there's something about the hour, you'll be one or two of them at 11, but come midnight, 1 a.m. or 2 a.m., there's nothing but step machines and bendy machines to tone your core.
I was actually reading something just this week about the strategy behind those late nights. So as we sit up and we're more and more tired and our inhibitions, you know, we just have less kind of self-control because we are tired, exhausted. Perhaps we've had that extra glass of wine and therefore we get pummeled with all of this advertising and we're just far more likely to go, oh yeah, I'll do that. I'll buy that.
Great idea. Why have I put it off?
I'll hit that button. Yeah, I really do need that gym equipment.
We're impulsive. And often it's a special offer, Ellen. Just for the next 5 minutes, there's a special offer.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, each of us is vulnerable to this messaging when we're tired, stressed, or distracted. Now, that certainly happens at 2 a.m., but it also increasingly happens throughout our waking lives. We're tired, we're stressed, we're distracted, and we're vulnerable to this messaging, which diminishes us. It tells us we're not enough. And when we feel that we're not enough or that everybody else is doing well, when we experience that sense of isolation, oh, everyone else is just so successful and happy. It's just me. Our courage is depleted. It's not our fault. If you're exposed to that, you're supposed to be depleted. Your courage will be eroded and you'll feel isolated, alone, and not enough to face the challenges that come in life. So that's the second human predicament, that we've fed a diet of junk values. The third human predicament is, I call it the biggest elephant, but there's a truth we dare not confront. But we should if we're going to live courageous lives. And the truth is we keep pushing it away, but it's that we are finite creatures and we are aware, unlike any other animal, I think, we are aware of our own mortality. But if you allow yourself to think for a moment, just a moment, about your personal annihilation, it's pretty distressing. you know, because we go to quite a lot of trouble, Ellen. I'm sure you do too, to stay alive. Mm-hmm. I expect you to go to quite a lot of trouble each day not to get run over.
Not to get killed, yes.
Not to get killed.
Not to die.
Yes, not to die. And so the predicament is that on the one hand, we've got this I must not die mindset, and at the same time, an awareness right up next to it that I must die. I must not die, and I must die. And this is completely intolerable to the human mind if you just glance at it quickly. It cannot be. It cannot be. So we've got to push one of them away. Well, which one should we get rid of? Well, it's the one that we're going to die. Mm. But when we put that out of our mind, if we're really successful, and we can have different levels of success in trying to kid ourselves about this, but if we're really successful, then we give ourselves permission to defer doing what matters now. Mm. Because if we've just got forever, well, what's the rush, Ellen? What's the urgency?
It's always next year
Yeah, we could do it at any time. And paradoxically, if we're willing to turn towards the fact, we cannot argue with this, the fact of our mortality, then paradoxically, it gives us a sense of urgency to live now. It doesn't destroy us and have us weeping and gnashing as we fear it will. It actually increases our vitality. We want to live and make things happen, and we're less willing to trade away our precious minutes watching Netflix or flicking aimlessly through Facebook, because our time is incomparably valuable.
And you do suggest an astonishing and in some ways kind of frightening tool in the book, and I did this.
Oh, yes.
And it's called Couch.life.
Couch.life.
It's a website. And so all our listeners can do this when they get a moment. And you pop in your date of birth and then your kind of expected longevity. So, you know, pick a number, hopefully in your 80s or 90s. And then it actually depicts where you're at in life, like how far down you are on a weekly basis, isn't it? It's like a little dot for each week. Is that right?
Exactly.
And so it's just a really, really simple graphic, but it does show you not only how many weeks of your life you've already had, I turned 48 last week, so there were, 48 times 52, how many weeks of your life you've had, but then, where you are kind of on the timeline, perhaps. And yeah, I can absolutely see, because it does. It gives you a really simple, easy graphical representation of the amount of time you've used and the amount of time you've potentially got left, which is a bit of a rocket to do a little bit more, not to put it off.
Nicely put, a rocket it is. It's one thing, I think, when we say to ourselves something like, I've got another 40 or 50 years of life to go, maybe. 40 years. Yeah, okay, that's one thing. But to actually see our years visually, to have a visual representation, and as you said, there's a little brick for every week. When you see the bricks that are left, it felt very different to me than just saying the words, I've got another 40 years, to actually see the bricks there.
But I think it's in reference to the ones that you've already used too, isn't it? Because if it was just those ones in the future, you don't necessarily get that perspective of how many, and this probably feels very different when you're 15. When you're 15, you've got, a little fraction of used blocks at the top and then a lot of unused blocks to come. But once you reach middle age, that proportion's changing.
Yes, it hits us in a number of ways. One is the years we've had, or the weeks we've had versus the weeks that are left. But another one is that there are no bricks after your last brick. So there's a visual of finality. There is nothing. Of course, other people will have bricks, so they'll be going on. But you stop. You stop. And when I looked at it, I certainly had the experience of, oh my God. First of all, it's a bit of shock. I thought there'd be a few more, Ellen. I thought when you saw the weeks. But the reality is, every one of us has weeks to live. everyone. Now, if we hear this from time to time, that people are going to the doctor and they say, I've got some bad news, you've got weeks to live. And people really step up and live lives of vitality and extraordinary meaning. And from time to time, you'll hear them say that that message gave them intensity of being alive that they'd never had before. But do you and I really want to wait until we're given a few weeks to live by our doctors? The reality is we already just have weeks to live. So if we could just accept that, be willing to acknowledge the truth of it, then I think you'll find there's an enormous activation of energy and willingness to live life and savor it, and not to trade away our lives doing meaningless things. Our willingness to choose, actually, is this how I want to be spending this day? Is that, or the next hour? Is that a good use? Because this isn't going on forever. We get better, I think, at choosing when we recognize just how valuable our time is, how extraordinarily valuable. Just to finish off one little idea here, is that there was a chap on the Sunshine Coast actually kept a coffin in his lounge. And the local paper came around and said, what on earth are you doing? Doesn't it, being reminded of your death all the time.
A bit macabre.
Isn't this a bit macabre? He said, you always think about death. He says, no, you misunderstand. I'm not thinking about death. When I see it, I'm reminded that I'm alive now. Mm. Each of us needs reminders that we are alive now for now. And when we can do that, it can really, as you said, put a rocket up our willingness to get on with it and live well and love well and work well.
And I think you used the word avoiding doing the meaningless things there. I think, you know, what strikes me in all of this is that it's not necessarily about throwing in your job because you want to have fun. I mean, obviously we'd all like to do that, but there's a lot more to it than that, isn't it? It's about finding the things that are meaningful. So if you have a job that you really don't enjoy, that is draining the spirit from you on a daily basis, then this might be the way to reframe having that courage to make a change. It's not necessarily an argument for us all just to abandon responsibilities in favor of fun and frivolity.
No, because I'm sure for many of your listeners, some of the things that make life meaningful will also include taking care of others, looking after those we live with or work with. And a meaningful life isn't one that's just fun all the time. Many of the most meaningful things we've all done in life actually have been extremely demanding and challenging, and you wouldn't put them on the fun scale.
You're not enjoying them while you're doing them.
No, but they're worthwhile. So it's less about what's fun and more about what's a worthwhile way to spend your life. And you make an important point. It's not necessary to throw in your career always. Sometimes, actually, on reflection, you might think, actually, this is not what I want to be doing for my entire life. And you may want to change. But it's possible to imbue any job with more meaning by bringing a certain attitude to it, to treating it as a craft, to recognizing what elements of the job could make it even more worthwhile for you.
Something that I know both you and I work with individuals on doing, finding that personal meaning. What is it that drives, motivates, inspires me? How do I find an opportunity? Job craft to create more opportunity to do those in the role that I'm in or in the workplace that I'm in, which is a very different way of looking at work, but an awful lot of fun to do.
It is, because it means that whatever we're doing today, whatever, we can experience greater meaning right away just by changing how we approach it, and maybe dial up some parts of the job and dial down others. But yes, adjust how we bring ourselves into the role.
Mm. which is fun. It's a different way of doing things. Mm-hmm. Eric, there are a couple of, there's quite a few chapters in here that I really, you know, I'm holding the book. I know this is where an audio medium and no one can see us. I'm holding the book.
I can confirm to listeners that I can see Ellen is holding my book.
Is holding the book, indeed. And one of them that I did want to pick up on, because I think this is an under-discussed topic. I know some of our listeners will be familiar with it. It's something that I've mentioned before, but on the whole, I think it's a very useful tool that is under-discussed in certainly in workplaces, but probably in life generally. And that is self-compassion. And, you know, why is it that self-compassion is really better, more effective than self-criticism when, as you said earlier, that negativity bias that we have promotes self-criticism. We're always telling ourselves what we're getting wrong, what we're messing up, what we can't do. But it's not a helpful tool, is it, when it comes to being your best self?
No. It wants to be used very sparingly, the self-criticism. So we're only motivated to do two things, to move towards pleasure and to move away from fear and threat and pain. So bearing that in mind, self-criticism is a motivational strategy to try to motivate ourselves to do something by moving away from pain. So when we're critical, we're admonishing ourselves, we're telling ourselves, we're putting ourselves down, we're feeling bad, and we're assuming, if I can make myself feel really bad, then I will be motivated to make the changes that I need, ask for what I want in my workplace, speak up, if I can just be really critical. And it is a motivational strategy, but it's motivating with fear. The alternative is to motivate with care or with love. So it's to motivate with kindness. And it doesn't sound like it, but when we motivate others with kindness, we actually create a more sustainable motivation. It lasts. And people, when they motivate with self-compassion, we're using kindness, but we're also doing two other things. There's two other ingredients in self-compassion. One of them is recognizing our common humanity, that we are not alone. Yes, I'm talking to myself. I feel really anxious. Everyone else I look at seems to really have it together. I'm looking at their outside, and I'm assuming that the insides are just as calm and smooth and easygoing as the outsides. It's not true. Everyone out there is worried and anxious, and if we could put a stethoscope onto anyone's head and listen to what they're saying, they're pretty much just like us. So if we can recognize, oh, hang on, it's not just me. We're all in the same boat. Mm. That can help us. It can help build our courage. And the final part of self-compassion is mindfulness. It's developing the capacity to hold our lived experience in balanced awareness, according to Christine Neff. That's her definition. Getting really good at noticing the unkind things we say to ourselves, the catastrophic predictions we say to ourselves. So it's a really honest way of approaching our experience, not trying to push it away, cover it up, paint over it. We're saying, yes, yeah, I am having difficult experiences. I am. And paradoxically, when we accept and allow and acknowledge that we are telling ourselves difficult things and we're experiencing difficult things, we experience Daniel Siegel's taming. Mm. The experience of fear or worry is reduced. It's still there, but it's reduced. And kindness, coupled with that mindfulness, coupled with an experience of our shared common humanity together, truly encourages us. It encourages us. And our blood chemistry changes. We get more oxytocin in our bloodstream, and it is literally an encouraging hormone. We are more willing to do what matters in the presence of discomfort. So, yes, self-compassion. Not an easy sell in the workplace. People generally are looking for something a bit more gritty, a bit more of a mental toughness type strategy. You can do it. But the evidence is people who are self-compassionate get more done, and they can sustain progress and achieve more for longer.
That's what I find so fascinating about it. I know there's also evidence to suggest that self-compassion plays a big part in reducing procrastination, which again is that same feedback loop, isn't it? That we tell ourselves that I have to, you know, I just have to get on with it. Why am I procrastinating? And you're so hopeless and you're wasting time. And all that does is keep us trapped in that loop of thinking. And yet if we're able to say to ourselves, right, I'm doing this, I'm doing it. Why am I doing it? Maybe because I'm tired, maybe because what I'm having to do is difficult or it causes me some emotional discomfort. It's boring or I resent it or, you know, whatever it might be. And then accept that, you know, what you're doing is just part of being human. We all do it. It then frees us up in this remarkable way that the self-criticism never, ever does. So a great thing to include in a book on being your best self is this relatively new notion that I think can really change our experience.
I'm with you, absolutely. Yes, self-criticism really does trigger reactivity. It triggers reactivity. Fear triggers reactivity. Criticism triggers reactivity. But if we want to make progress, do what's hard, do what's meaningful, we need to trigger proactivity instead. And we can do that through self-compassion, through being kind and understanding towards ourselves. It gives us the capacity to choose to do what matters. While we're reactive, our ability to choose anything is massively diminished. We're just on reactive autopilot.
Mm. While we're talking about being proactive and making choices, you do finish the book with your 7 steps to becoming your best self. And I'm not going to get you to go through them all because that would just be giving it away. People need to go buy the book and read it to find out. But, you know, what are the essence of the 7 steps? How does that chapter, you know, help us? It's really the how-to, isn't it?
Yes. Well, the first 4 steps are preparation. It's getting ready to meet challenges. And it's really important that we do have a preparation piece so that we know what matters, so that we are vigilant for the stories we tell ourselves, for these uncomfortable thoughts and feelings that derail us, so that we're ready to recognize when we're being derailed. But perhaps I'll share the final 3 steps, because the last 3 are, once we've worked out what's important, we need to notice when we're being challenged, we need to name it, and then we need to ask ourselves a question. Now what would the person I want to be do? Notice, name, now what?
The three N's.
And we can do those provided we've built the skills that we've talked about today, skills of stepping back from difficult thoughts and feelings, skills of noticing. And we can do that provided we've done those first 4 steps in the model, which is the preparation. The 7-step model is in chapter 12, but I might mention that the first chapter of the book is available to be freely downloaded from my website.
We will put a link to that in the show notes.
Great. Thank you.
And I love that it finishes with that now what, because I think that's the thing that we so often forget when it comes to a lot of personal development stuff. We spend a lot of time introspecting and exploring and understanding, and perhaps not enough emphasis is put on what we do about it. And I think that really simple question of now what is really the prompt for all of us to move that intention into a form of action, to say, right, you know, what am I going to do about this? How does this inform me so that I can do things differently if it hasn't worked out, or I need to take that extra step, or I've got goals that I want to pursue, or I'm just scared. I don't know how to move forward from that. That now what is a really simple, lovely way to frame that movement.
Yeah, we need to take action. We can't just, well, we could spend a lifetime chewing over, introspecting, as you say, getting very clever, but never actually doing very much. So yeah, the last part is the most important one. It's what everything leads up to. The first 6 steps are only there so that we perform the 7th. Now, what would the person you want to be do? And we do that.
Eric, it's been a joy to talk to you today. I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. The book is, as I mentioned from the outset, and we will put all of these details, including that link to the downloadable chapter, in our show notes, but it's Swipe Right on Your Best Self, Simple Steps to a Bolder Life with Fewer Regrets. Congratulations on it. I've enjoyed it. I'm sure it will be very useful, powerful. I love that coaches, psychologists, and others are out there providing it to their clients as a resource and a handbook as well. That is scaling up, isn't it? It's actually, you know, that kind of systemic approach to making change in our community, which I think is a wonderful goal, and you're playing a big part in that. So thank you very much for your time today.
Ellen, it's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Wasn't that a fun conversation? Eric is great to talk to. And his book, Swipe Right on Your Best Self, is a treat. We've added a link to the book and Eric's website where you'll find out more about all of his work to the show notes for this episode. Go to potential.com.au/podcast. And there you'll also find a link to grab your copy of my how-to guide to create thriving, motivated teams. And there's going to be plenty more how-to guides and resources for creating positive, thriving workplaces coming up on the Potential Psychology website in the next few months as we continue our so far largely behind the scenes refresh and refocus to help leaders to be their best selves so that they can help their people to be their best too. This is work that I've been doing for many, many years face-to-face, but now we're bringing it to a wider audience with a greater online presence. It's very exciting stuff. But I guess it might be time to talk about what's coming up on the show next. Well, our next episode is actually our last for 2020. It will land in mid-December, and we're doing something a little different. I'm not going to give it away. Let's keep it a surprise, but it will be fun. It will be a little reflective, and it will be quite international. But until then, go well. Take small steps, or great big ones if you're ready, to fulfill your potential. And I will see you next time.